Jamie, and welcome very much to 2ARM FM 92.1. Damien, you're down there in Walker.
I am. It's a great little town.
I know, but Walker's been undergoing a bit of a big shaking, hasn't it, in relation to the renewable energy zone?
Yeah, it sure has, Margaret. To put it into perspective, the New England RES zone has been designated at somewhere between 8 and 10 gigawatts of renewable energy projects. And to put that into perspective, the next largest is Arana, which is at 3 gigawatts.
Yes, and that's way out at Dubbo, isn't it, in that region, that way, yeah.
So it encompasses Dubbo, Orange, Bathurst, Wellington, etc., a population far greater than what the New England is.
And with a lot more sort of open space too, really, flat plains and things like that, whereas we're quite mountainous. Yeah.
But our little town of 3,000 people has accumulated projects on the table adding up to 4 gigawatts of projects. So that's about 660, 230-metre wind turbines and about, I think on last count it was over 4 million solar panels. And that's on some of the state's most productive agricultural land. And, of course, we're blessed in the fact that we're surrounded by World Heritage National Parks.
Yes, it's a funny decision, and in a way, and one where I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Damien, but there was very little consultation with the community before the renewable energy zone was designated or announced by the New South Wales government. Is that correct?
Absolutely none. And as evidence to make it specific into the project that we're dealing with at the moment, which is our first project, 119 230-metre wind turbines out in the Winterbourne area, which borders onto the Oxley Wild Rivers National Park and the Gondwana rainforest area, which has UNESCO ratings, which we're very blessed to have. But the EIS is in submission, is on public display at the moment. And Margaret, as a community group, the Voice for Walker ran an open survey, and we had some 520 of our little over 2,000 adult residents respond to that survey. So we thought that that was an extraordinary amount of effort that was put into the community.
Well, it's over 25%, and I mean, that does really break records for community sort of response, because it's rare for you to get that proportion of people actually taking the time to put in a written response.
100%. And what that uncovered for us was that 80% of the Walker residents were indeed against the project, but we were blessed to show that everyone could have participated in it. There were some 46 of the 520 respondents that were in favour of it. So we did really reach out to the whole community, but more importantly, Margaret, 86% of those respondents said that the developer Vestas had failed to adequately engage, consult and communicate with the community.
I mean, this is emerging as one of the biggest problems. Not only did the government not engage, consult with the community about the RES itself, but now we're seeing these extremely, I presume Vestas is a global company?
It's actually a Danish company. So to give you a timeline of ownership, the Winterbourne Wind Project was developed by a fellow, Mark Waring, who has a business called Walker Energy, which is based in Walker. He has then on-sold that project. So once he gets the 24 farmers signed up that can accommodate the 119 turbines, he on-sells it to Vestas, who are a Dutch wind turbine manufacturer. And indeed, they have now on-sold the project. And this is before even planning approval has been granted, but it is now owned by Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, which is a Danish superannuation fund.
Mm.
And just to highlight the contempt in which these multinational companies are holding our little community, Margaret.
Yep.
The EIS is 4,000 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
We're a group, we're a small community, we're blessed with some really intelligent people within the community, but more importantly, some people that are very passionate about their community and are very generous, both in their time and mm-hmm. with their money. So we are devouring that EIS as best as we can in the 28-day display period.
So when does it run out?
We were actually granted an extension until the 22nd of January. So
right.
we felt very fortunate that Adam Marshall wrote a letter to the planning minister, and that was the first extension that a project was granted. So we got an extension to the 22nd of January, but of course, over the Christmas period, you want to spend that with your family, your friends, and really getting away from your business and your farm.
Well, I mean, we're all, I can speak myself, I'm actually planning a fair bit of work in January, but I mean, it's work that I can't normally do because January's generally a freer month when people are taking their summer holidays and trying to recuperate for the onslaught of the next year. But, so it's against these sort of consultation periods in January seem unfair because that's the time when, in Australia, most of us try and take a break from normal business. And
Yeah.
But,
Margaret, we were really disturbed as late as yesterday afternoon.
Right.
We went into the Vestas office, so they've put a pop-up office in Walker while this EIS is in display.
Yeah.
And two of their consultants, and remembering that it's a 4,000-page document, it has been reported that it was about $3,000 a page to produce. And Vestas quoted us that it cost $2 million just to submit it to the state government for planning approval.
Right.
And we highlight some of the inaccuracies that we had found. And we were looking for clarification. And the response back to us, Margaret, which was really disturbing.
This is yesterday afternoon, Damien.
Yeah. Was that the document is fluid.
Oh, yeah.
And they expect that the community will find the many errors that is within that document.
Oh, really? You're the proofreaders.
And highlight it to Vestas. Yeah, and highlight it to the developer, of which they will make amendments to the document. So they use the word, there are components that are generic within the EIS.
Oh, which means they've used a template and just bunged it onto the Winterburn project.
It could be concluded that that's the case, certainly, Margaret. But as a community of volunteers, this document has, you know, been prepared. Vestas have owned the project for over 4 years. They have a team of highly paid consultants put the EIS document together. There's a planning act that the EIS document must represent the project. And if it indeed is full of mistruths, you could say,
or inaccuracies. Same thing, really. Yep.
That we have to find as community members, being volunteers and certainly amateurish, because this is the first EIS I've certainly ever looked at. And to find those and for them to then enforce us with their amendments down the track, we found quite flabbergasting. And What made it worse, Margaret, is that we've probably got combined over 2,000 hours and we're only into week three now in scouring this document.
Yeah.
We've employed a professional noise consultant.
Right.
Because their noise component was simulated.
Right.
We've also employed a lawyer to write our community submission. So this is at great cost. both in dollar terms but also time terms.
Yeah.
And for the developer to treat us with such contempt that they say, yeah, yeah, it's an incomplete document and we released it because we were under commercial time constraints.
Mm.
So they know it's not an accurate document, yet they've still enforced it upon our community over the Christmas break.
Well, I would imagine this is going to become a major election issue because the New South Wales government is the one that's basically put communities in this extremely unbalanced, disempowered position. Do you think that will happen, Damien?
Well, I certainly think that it will become an election issue, Margaret, both at our local government level in the New England, but then more importantly in our March state elections. And to quote, there was a meeting held in Armidale with ENCO, who is the market regulator,
yeah,
and the New South Wales.
That's Energy Co. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. And that meeting was held in Armidale last week, and there were some 11 community groups that attended that, and there was a strong common theme that the lack of community engagement and consultation and transparency with these projects was a major, major issue. And I'd like to reference also to our First Nations people. There are significant sites throughout the New England, and the Dungati people down here in Walker, they were referenced twice in the 4,000-page document. And in actual fact, it was highlighted by one of the Dungati ladies at that ENCO meeting that she was actually called, she was part of Amaru, and it wasn't the case. Like, they didn't even know what her mob was.
So they didn't know the tribal identity and the clan and cultural identity of the First Nations people whose sacred sites and traditions this project is likely to impact.
Correct.
Yeah. Damien, before we go on, can you tell me what the Winterbourne project basically consists of? So, well, you have really. So it's 119 of these.
Yeah. Further to that, Margaret, that there's 119 230-metre wind turbines to produce enough energy to support around 2.5 million homes in New South Wales.
Right, and the point is that, so for anybody, I mean, this might seem a bit naive, but the fact is that that energy goes straight onto transmission lines which join a major upgraded grid which will take it to other parts of Australia. There's no necessary energy benefit to the host communities. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And to the point where that was one of the points of inaccuracy that we took to Vestas yesterday, because these big multinational developers come into town, and this is a town of 3,000 people, Margaret.
Yeah,
but we love our town.
Of course.
And, they're asking us to host for 2.5 million homes, or a bit over 6 million people in New South Wales.
Yeah.
And that they talk about a community benefit scheme. That is yet to be signed off with the developer. So whilst they say it's a commitment...
But what is it?
It's pittance in comparison to the revenue that the project will generate. But more importantly, they had in their EIS document about a neighbour sharing fund. And that was actually thrown out over 12 months ago.
Mm.
Yet it still appears as one of the benefits of the project in the EIS document. And we look at that document as the holy grail. That outlines the detail, the location, the type, the detail around that document, and they've admitted that it's incorrect.
So you've got a document that the Vestas, the proponent, is relying on. Well, they're going to push it through to the state government, and any errors, they're relying on the community to point them out. And in relation to the very, very important issue of what community benefit Arrangements. I mean, there's contractual arrangements to deliver some kind of, you know, substantial community benefit, like a future fund or money to go to a future fund, and they need to be relative to the value of the product being generated from the host land and the host community. Do you think you're in a good...
Could not agree more. But certainly that commitment has still not been signed off on. So I would like to think, Margaret, if I ever made $1 billion, I'd be happy to commit $1 million to you. I've never met you yet, but that's essentially what they're saying, is that we commit to give the Walker community pittance in comparison to the revenue that's generated from our project.
Yeah.
But indeed, that's still not signed off on.
I just want to say something here, Damien. I was at the local government conference a few weeks ago, and a motion was put up requiring Sydney people, who would probably comprise a large part of that, the beneficiary of the power that's being generated in these magnificent World Heritage areas, Sydney people to start to share in power generation with rooftop, you know, being the hosts themselves of rooftop solar. And in fact, I was lined up at the microphone to speak, but in front of me was Linda Scott, who's Councillor Linda Scott of Sydney City Council, and she's also the former president of Local Government New South Wales, and now she's the president of the national body, which is Australian Local Government Association. And she said emphatically that Sydney people, metropolitan city dwellers, need to take up their share of the burden of, you know, decarbonising our energy supplies. But this is not something that's currently being contemplated by the New South Wales government, is it?
No, it's not. No, I'm glad that Linda Scott was able to put that point of view forward. And to give you some background, Margaret, our family, like my wife and three kids, we've actually been living off-grid on our farm for the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So our personal energy supply comes from rooftop solar.
Yeah.
And of course, like as farmers, like we really are trying to put and look after and encourage the biodiversity on our farm.
Yep.
And the idea of rooftop solar contributing, and you look at all of those rooftops that are down in our metropolitan cities, whereby this energy from the New England RES is going to be shipped to, the biodiversity has already been affected, like the house has been built. So you could put an energy source on those and not change the biodiversity or the ecological footprint of the energy supply source.
That's right, because basically they're living in suburban houses with a clothesline out the back, maybe concrete path to the front door and a few roses and lawns, you know, in the front yard, and maybe some veggies out the back. That's it for biodiversity. It's not very biodiverse because it's heavily settled, I guess, whereas, and they could contribute to solar collection.
100%, Margaret, and to put that into perspective, so we alluded to the fact that this Winterbourne, the 33,000 hectare footprint that these 119 turbines will sit on, is on the edge of the Oxley Wild Rivers National Park and the Gondwana State Forest, UNESCO rated as that area. They did a biodiversity study in 2019, in the early spring of 2019.
Know what year that was.
The worst drought in history, recorded history.
Worst drought in recorded white ox settlement, settled Australia history, yeah.
And coming out of a New England winter, not surprisingly, Margaret, there has been no snakes, lizards, or indeed wedge-tail eagles identified in their wildlife report. The wedge-tail eagles are magnificent. And within that footprint, there are actually two farms that reference Eagle's View and Eagle's Nest.
The Walker area is famous for properties named after the eagle impact. I mean, the eagles in the area, it's really one of the sort of significant features of the wildlife around Walker, isn't it?
It is, Margaret, and it's something that a lot of tourists rely on. And the biodiversity is something that our agricultural community relies on. So that's what really bemuses me. So we would love the state government to really become involved and look at the appropriateness of these renewable developments. So, yes, we all want to contribute to a net zero economy, but there is no doubt about that. And we all want to play our roles. But it's putting these projects in the right place, the right location, and then the right size. So to burden a little town of 3,000 people with enough projects that would make it larger than the Arana Res
on its own.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And this is something that that the city folk might really like to hear, Margaret, because if you look at it, like, there are still major issues. Like, these turbines have never been produced or erected onshore. And Vestas is a Danish wind turbine manufacturer.
Oh, hang on. Didn't you say it was a retirement fund?
Oh, well, Vestas have sold it on to Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners.
Oh, sorry. But so Vestas was the Dutch company that...
Yeah.
So Vestas that are the manufacturers of these huge infrastructure. Yeah.
And in this instance, they're the project developers of the Winterbourne Wind project.
Oh, right. Okay, now, so they're still involved, obviously. It's not just the Danish people.
They're the face. Well, they're both Danish. Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners is a Danish hedge fund.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but Vestas, just to put it into perspective, the turbines are right on the edge of the national park.
Right.
And there's been many studies, and indeed in Denmark, they've got six national parks. There is not one wind farm around their national parks. However, they're going to be building these 230-metre monstrosities right on the edge of one of our most sacred and beautiful national parks in New South Wales.
Yeah.
And there's a real issue, like, with microplastics from these and the effect that it may have on our native flora and fauna. And there are studies to show that a 4.2 megawatt turbine releases 62 kilos of microplastics a year. So if you multiply that by 119 turbines, there's nearly 7.5 tons of microplastics, some that are highly toxic.
This is microplastics released by abrasion with the blades.
Correct.
The wind abrading the blades, and I've also heard from the Sapphire and other areas around Glen Innes where the wind turbines are up that the blades are not lasting 25 years. They're having to be replaced, you know, within 2, 3, 4, or 5 years.
Yep. Mm. Yep. So we have major decommissioning risk associated with these projects. But over the lifetime. So if indeed that this project does last its 30 years, as the developer is claiming, they're putting 222 tonnes of microplastics, toxic microplastics, into our World Heritage National Park.
Yeah, and there's a lot of water that that's, you know, got a huge impact on sort of water sources and the purity of...
It's massive, Margaret. That goes into the Macleay catchment, so it's eastern Fore country. So all of that water runs east and out to the sea. So the compounding effect is massive. And I'm glad that you mentioned water, because that was another inaccuracy that we've found.
Yeah.
So the dust suppression to build the 113 kilometres of internal farm tracks to get the 558 vehicle movements per day on the site. So they're 90-metre blades, Margaret, that have to be brought in.
Yeah.
And we've worked out, so in the EIS, Vestas have claimed 116 megalitres of water claimed. In a meeting that the Voice for Walker had with Vestas, they claim 220 megalitres of water.
Mm.
We've done some simple maths and we've verified, had it verified by a large contractor that's been involved in these sorts of projects.
Yeah.
For dust suppression and to build the concrete pads that these monstrosities sit on, it's closer to 760 megalitres of water.
Mm.
Now, Walker has just been given a grant to build a new water storage dam.
Yeah.
It's 330 megalitres.
So, basically...
So they would empty the Walker water storage more than two times over.
So... It's just quite horrific, the whole picture, isn't it? That Walker grant, I mean, if you do simple maths on it, two-thirds of that new water storage would be basically for the benefit of this project. And this is only the first project, isn't it?
Well, we're really hoping, and in the EIS document, once again, these are commitments and not signed off on.
Mm.
But they claim that they will get their water from four main storage places.
Hmm.
One is that they could enter into an agreement to buy the water from Walker. Our council has assured us that that will not be happening.
Yeah.
The other one is that they will drop a bore, so they'll tap into the artesian basin.
Which is a major supply for farms, and the whole water system is dependent in these high country places of underground water. Yeah.
It's our life. Hmm. Like, water is our life. The other one is to use the harvestable rights within the footprint. So once again, taking valuable water from stock and domestic use and putting it into large-scale industrial use.
Mm.
And the third one is that they want to tap into a large private dam that is 20 kilometres to the north of the project footprint. And it's actually on a farm in Dangersley. So...
That's going to have impacts way outside the region, isn't it? Your region, I mean the Walker area. I mean, if there's a big transfer of water from Dangersley,
it's enormous, and just the truck movement. So you talk about the erosion of roads, the effect on traffic, the effect on our health services, our emergency services, our ability to fight fires in and around. Prime agricultural land and World Heritage National Park. It's just an inappropriate location. And excuse me. And I think Vestas's comments, which aren't the first time that they've, you know, held the Walker community in contempt, clearly identify that these are not the developers that a small community wants to go into partnership with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you need developers who are willing to take you in. And I think this is starting to be learnt. I've been on the receiving end of a couple of briefings from proposed proponents, you know, for renewable energy projects. And they, you know, they admit there are cowboys in the industry that are really doing them a lot of harm, but they also say they want to be in on the ground floor with the community. They want to get the substantial community benefit that's fair to happen. And so I guess the point I'm making is that there is a different and better way of doing this that basically allows for the community and the proponent to work their way through the issues and develop something at a scale that's acceptable and fair. Would you agree with that?
Excuse me. 100%, Margaret. That has been our modus operandi from the get-go.
Yeah.
So in forming the Voice for Walker, we wanted to understand what the community would accept, what the community would tolerate.
Yeah,
and
I mean...
We're not anti-renewables. We want to participate and pull our weight.
That's right. Yeah, it seems like this has basically happened at... I mean, governments are in place in order to protect their communities at the end of the day, and it seems that not enough regulatory process or research has been done in the process.
We feel very procedurally biased. Like, We're under a lot of pressure to digest an EIS document of 4,000 pages.
Mm.
We're volunteers. We're not getting paid to do this.
No.
The only upside is that we protect our community and our local resources and assets in a state that we've come to love and respect, and we want to build it and grow it. Walker's a unique town. It's thriving. It's got businesses. It's got young people coming back to it. It's got a diverse culture. Its arts culture is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Walker has the only, I think, outdoor sculpture gallery in Australia.
And I think we're up to over 60 of those sculptures now. If you want to call in at Walker, it's a great art walk.
That's right. It really is. And, just really always take my hat off to Walker people. They do everything really well.
In this instance, we've had a multinational company come into our community.
Yeah.
And they haven't done it well.
No. So, look, if people want to understand a little bit more about some of these issues, they can go and listen, as I did this before the show, to Voice for Walker, which is a website. And there's some really interesting podcasts that you can listen to from that website. Is that, that's correct, is it not?
Yeah, it is. So voiceforwalker.com, if you put that into your Google search. And that's been put together by a group of volunteer community members, and we're really proud of that because there's a lot of information on it.
Mm.
And as you allude to, if you don't want to read it, you can listen to it. So,
it's
great.
It's really great, and it's got interviews with farmers and people who've been invited to be part of this, and just saying all the you know, obviously the money's very tempting because these companies have a lot of money to offer to the farmers who occupy or own the land that they want to use. But on the other hand, most farmers, graziers, whatever, they've got a deep sense of responsibility for their own country, their cattle, but also the biodiversity that they are the stewards of. So some of these issues, just the little bit that I had the chance to listen to, are really well explained in those podcasts.
We're very proud of it. So, happy to encourage all of your listeners to tap into the Voice for Walker.
Right, yeah. And there's another group, Renewable Energy, Red 4.
So we're blessed, and Red 4 is more of an overarching one. So they're looking at the whole of the New England Res Zone. So they organised the meeting that was held in Armidale last week.
Yeah.
They did a fantastic job.
Mm.
And they brought the 11 community groups together to present to ENCO and to the planning department. And I think it really left them with their eyes wide open going, wow, we didn't realise how affected these communities were.
Well, that's right. That one is R-E-D, numeral 4.
N-E.
New England, N-E. Yeah. So if you put that in your search engine, you'll also find some interesting material there on this issue.
For sure. And we really thank Red for New England for trying to bring all of the little communities together and hopefully put some influence into the planning department and our politicians to say what is appropriate for the New England. And I certainly don't think it's 10 gigawatts of renewable energy projects.
Well, it just seems so obviously unfair that an area that, to be honest, has probably been, to a certain extent, the subject of neglect for many decades, from state government expenditure, is now being asked to bear a very, very disproportionate burden of hosting renewable energy, whereas other areas, for example Arana, but other places, including the metropolitan roof landscape, are being asked either a lot less or, in fact, in the case of the metros, nothing.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem equitable at all. Damien, I think we've explored quite a few of the issues, and if people want to hear more and, in fact, get involved, because whether or not you're going to be impacted personally, if you really love our region, this is a matter for everybody, and especially to get behind communities that are impacted like Walcha is being at the moment. Because, I mean, this is just the first project. I mean, I know, for example, the village of Ben Lomond is struggling with the Erangoon project. They're trying to get changes made to the array of wind towers, but the initial plan was to ring the village with these huge towers, and that has also gone through at least three series of ownerships, which makes, you know, dealing with these huge multinational companies really difficult for just a bunch of villagers.
It sure does. Yep.
Yeah.
And
so,
Margaret, we would very humbly ask if you do feel that you could make a contribution to it, look under the Winterborne Wind EIS on the government portal and make a submission. It'll take 5 minutes of your time, but the cumulative effect, the roads, the water, the visual, the noise, like there are many, many issues that are going to affect our town and have, you know, it's repercussions for the whole state and indeed the country for generations to come, because it's questionable as to whether these wind farms actually even work. And you see in Europe, they're pulling them down. And why do we have a Dutch wind manufacturer out here in Australia? Because we're last cab to the rain.
That's right. You mean he's unloading stuff that he can no longer sell closer to home?
Correct. Mm. And so if you do make a submission, and it really is a numbers game, we would be very, very grateful if you did do that.
So how would people do that, Damien? They would go to the New South Wales Department of Planning?
Yeah, so if you simply put into your Google search Winterborne Wind EIS, and that will bring up the New South Wales Planning Portal, and then you just you can click there, make a submission, and if indeed that doesn't work, feel free to contact the Voice for Walcha.
Yep.
And we're volunteer manning a pop-up shop during the public display period, Monday to Friday, and we can help you that process.
So you can find that in the Walcha Main Street, is that right?
Yep, in the main street of Walcha at the Walcha Telly Cottage.
The Walcha Telly Cottage. Is that the New England Highway access or the Oxley?
It's on the Tamworth Road, on the Oxley Highway, next door to the best butcher shop in the New England.
All right. Okay, next door to the butchers. Terrific. Yep. Well, so very excellent. Obvious. And so Winterborne spelt with an E.
Yes.
So that's
Winterborne.
Winterborne Wind EIS dot, and then that'll come up with the Department of Planning's portal, and then you click make a submission and just say what you think on that submission, and don't think it won't matter, because it will, because the numbers are important, but you can raise particular issues like there's inadequate community consultation, or, you know, what's going to happen with the disposal of these products in 25 to 30 years and sooner. We now know that these blades are degrading much faster than was originally predicted, and so blades are having to be, and they're huge, are having to be buried. Well, where are they going? And your tip? I mean,
well, that's they certainly, well, council have said that they certainly will not be going in there into our waste, and there's not one blade that can be recycled at the moment. And these multinational companies say, don't worry, guys, in 30 years we'll have the technology that we'll be able to recycle them.
One of the things I think that's very scary right across the res in New England is that they're only really considering the disposal issue 6 years out from the end of the life of... So that means if it goes in, well, it's a 25-year life, but only in the year 16 of the life. Now, that's a long way ahead, or it feels like it, but it'll come pretty soon, and it probably will be a problem for the next generation as well.
And who'll indeed own these projects in 19 years' time, Margaret?
That's like, right.
If they've had three owners before they've even started, who's going to own them? And that line of risk for disposable or decommissioning could lie back on the hands of New South Wales taxpayers?
Well, it very well could, because as I've been told by a former Upper House member, that's what the New South Wales does. It cleans up the mess, you know, that's left. But will it be able to? Will it be able to afford to? Or will the communities that are hosting them just be left with this degrading plastic and concrete and mess? You know, what is the plan for covering over the massive amounts of concrete that are buried in the ground?
Well, Margaret, that's actually interesting, because there's 7,000 cubic metres of concrete in the footing of these, and all for rehabilitation, all that is required under current planning law is that there's 8 inches or 250 mils of topsoil that's put on top of the concrete.
Is ridiculous. I mean, 250 mils is not enough to grow decent grass like Phalaris, or, you know, even the most basic ground cover, let alone, you know, to allow for complete regeneration.
Correct.
And those concrete pads are large. But anyway, look, if people want to make that submission, that's Winterbourne Wind EIS, to put in your Google search bar, and the two organisations to check out are, and I think probably the first one to hear a little bit more of what you're saying is the Voice for Walca. That's Voice singular, Voice for Walca, and the other one is RED, which stands for RED.
Red for New England, which is Responsible Energy Development for New England.
And do it all. Just get engaged, because at the moment it's like, I just get the feeling, but I guess this is just my opinion, it was considered that these sleepy little hollows weren't going to have a voice, and it was intended that they would just quietly let all this happen. And so put this enormous problematic development somewhere where people wouldn't have a voice, perhaps. Well, I think it's important that everybody considers their right to speak in a democracy.
Couldn't agree more, and thank you for your time, and really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Margaret.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much. I've been speaking to Damien Timms, who's one of the volunteers. He's a farmer and very thoughtful person, along with many, many other residents of Walca who are just basically trying to work and absorb this enormous impact of this proposed Winterbourne wind farm in the national park, and all the impacts that its construction and destruction, its end of life activities will have on the Walca community. So thank you so much, Damien. I'm going to end the call here, and hopefully I can get back onto air. Thank you.